can you hear me in the back? Okay, great. So I'm going to continue where we left off on Tuesday, talking a little bit about stem cells. And if you remember, I spoke to you about the fact that stem cells have two characteristics. They're self-renewing, and they can differentiate upon induction. Okay? And I spoke to you about a number of different places where you could get naturally occurring stem cells. Okay? And among them was also the adult stem cells. Remember, we spoke about the fact that we already do bone marrow transplants with adult stem cells. Today I'd like to talk to you about two different ways that we use to create stem cells, okay? The first way, or to create pluripotent stem cells, so that's not really the same as the adult stem cells, which would only be multipotent. Here we're going to talk about pluripotent stem cells. So the first one would be somatic nuclear transfer. And this is what you think of when you hear that they cloned Dolly, right? The sheep that was cloned back in 97, okay? Since then, they've actually cloned, in addition to sheep, they've also cloned dogs, okay? Someone who had a dog that saved her life, she felt the need to have another one like that. Cats, horses, right? They want this, if this thoroughbred was a great racer, let's make another one just like it. So they've done all of that. For a while, they had trouble cloning primates. They've actually now managed to clone a monkey, right? They had to actually change the procedure slightly. But they haven't actually managed to clone yet humans, okay? So what did they do to clone the sheep, okay? And I guess before I start, I should talk to you a little bit about why they did it in 97, okay? They didn't do it to create, you know, let's say a billionaire wanted to pay to have lots of himself. They didn't pay to, they weren't doing it for that, okay? The reason that they were doing it is because they wanted to show that all of the DNA is inside the nucleus of the cell, even when it has fully progressed down that cell fate differentiation pathway, okay? And so all of the DNA that is needed to make a whole human being is inside of the nucleus. That was really the point behind making Dolly. Okay, so keep that in your mind as we talk about it. So what did they do? They took an egg. And I will tell you that the egg is kind of considered the secret to life because somehow it manages to reprogram everything and start over again. Okay? They took the egg and they got rid of its nucleus. And then they took a fully differentiated cell, and they could have taken it from anywhere, okay, any of the fully differentiated cells in the body. They chose to take it from the udder of another sheep, of a different sheep, okay? And so if this is that cell, it has a nucleus, they took that nucleus and put it inside of the egg. Oh, and I should mention, this is on 20A. You can follow along with me if you'd like. Oh, I'm sorry, 19A. Right, it's actually from last time. Got my times all confused. Okay, 19B, even more confusing. Okay. And so then once they had this egg, okay, and they took out its nucleus and then took a fully differentiated cell and put its nucleus inside of the egg, they then grew those cells in the lab inside a dish, okay? And you'd start to get a little ball of cells, okay? And once that had grown enough, they then took that and put it into the sheep uterus. And after a while, Dolly was born. So Dolly actually lived to be about six, which was a little early. She died a little early from lung disease. She had some arthritis too. But she did give birth. And they called the offspring Polly. So obviously viable enough to give birth. So what do we see here? Because the egg, okay, which was from a one sheep, and the nucleus was from another, they could then go and check and see if the various characteristics that Dolly had were due now to, should be from the nuclear DNA that's identical to this sheep. Okay? And so what they were able to show by using an egg from one individual and a nucleus from another sheep, they could show that Dolly, actually, all of the characteristics of Dolly came from this nuclear DNA, rather than the DNA that was extracted to begin with. Okay? Now, I haven't actually told you everything, because we have DNA from another place. Most of our DNA, right, so mitochondria. So most of our DNA is from the nucleus. But the egg will have lots of mitochondria. Okay, so if we have lots of mitochondria in here, it means that Dolly is not a perfect clone, right, like identical twins would be, but rather, Dolly has nuclear DNA from sheep. If this is sheep A, and this is sheep B, Dolly would have from sheep A, mitochondrial, this is the DNA, mitochondrial DNA, and from sheep B, nuclear DNA. And so this was in 97, and then about 3 years ago, there was a scientist in South Korea named Huang who said, okay, I have now made blastocysts from this procedure in humans. And I have my blastocysts frozen in liquid nitrogen. People in general, scientists do not try to actually make the whole individual, okay? So they had the blastocysts in liquid nitrogen. And this was published, it was a big thing. Oh my goodness, we've cloned humans. And it turns out that they then went and checked to see whether or not they had cloned humans. So what did they do? Well, it turns out they went and looked to see if the nuclear DNA and the mitochondrial DNA were both from the same source or from two different sources like you'd expect if you did somatic nuclear transfer. And what they saw when they checked the blastocysts is that the nuclear and mitochondrial DNA is from the same source. So he could not have done somatic nuclear transfer. Okay? Now, a student will ask me, okay, but isn't it possible that we could take a woman and use her egg and her nucleus and make a perfect clone? We could, okay, if we wanted to, right? The question is, right, what do we actually want to do with these embryos? Scientists in general are not looking to make human clones and clone ourselves, okay? What we frequently would like to do is to be able to take these cells at the blastocyst stage and use the ICM cells, or the inner cell mass, those pluripotent cells that we talked about that will become parts of the embryo, and extract them and put them in a petri dish as we talk about ES cells, those embryonic stem cells, and drive those down various lineages, for example, neurons or heart cells, to help people who have neurodegenerative diseases or heart attacks. That's really why we want to do this procedure. And so, most of the time, the people that need this are not of reproductive age. Okay, so usually you cannot take the same woman's egg and nucleus because, let's say, the woman is 60 or 70 years old when they have the neurodegenerative disease. And so the egg isn't around anymore. Also, don't forget that 50% of patients are male, so you can never take their egg. So truthfully, in general, okay, we wouldn't normally be making perfect clones just because of logistically it doesn't work out well. But what is very interesting is that if we took these ES cells, right, let's say we're talking about people, right, in this case. If person B had a neurodegenerative disease. And we took their nucleus and used it here to create ES cells, okay, embryonic stem cells, and we then made them into neurons, and we then injected them into their brain. All the proteins that are expressed in those cells, or at least most of them, okay, will actually be derived from that same B individual. So no need for immunosuppressors. Okay? And so you've gotten rid of that problem that you do have with organ transplant. You would not have to live the rest of your life on immunosuppressors because all the proteins are the same as yours. Okay? And so this is really the idea behind using somatic nuclear transfer to create ES cells, to create various cells of the body, to help during various diseases. Okay? So this is one strategy we've used to create pluripotent stem cells. What is the other strategy? So I'll mark that as one. The other strategy is induced pluripotent stem cells, which we abbreviate IPS. And what is that? So this was actually only figured out about 2 years ago by a guy named Yamanaka. Listen for that name when the Nobel Prizes are announced soon, because he definitely is in line for one. And what he did was, he took skin cells, okay? And this means that they're readily available and easy, right? A lot of less ethical issues than if you use an egg, okay? So he took skin cells, so I'll denote a skin cell here. And he took DNA that encoded 4 transcription factors, okay, and he used a virus to actually inject them into the cell. So 4 transcription factors, right, he actually injected the DNA so the cell would then make the proteins. And he got those cells, now this was in a petri dish, so now in a petri dish, he was able to get pluripotent cells. Well, you can imagine that now you could take various factors and induce them to become neurons, to become heart, to become kidney cells. So this has many possible applications. One of the things that is a little bit of an issue for using this in humans is I mentioned that they use viruses to get these transcription factors in. Okay? And that can be an issue, right, with viruses into humans. Okay? So they really have to work on that. But this is very promising. Okay, so in both of these cases, we end up having ES cells that we hope down the road will help us, with help people with various diseases. But there's also been some exciting things that we've actually been able to do. I spoke about the fact that we do already with adult stem cells, we do bone marrow transplants. But there's also another issue, and that is that when we inject these cells, we frequently inject them into a tissue that has formed, okay, and they kind of contribute, or hopefully contribute to that tissue. But we have a problem in that in the petri dish, we're not very good at making shape or form of an organ, okay? And there's been a little bit of progress in that field. What we see. What we see is that, so form is an issue. Normally, things form in the body by all kinds of interactions between various tissues. We don't have that luxury in the petri dish. We can give it various signals, okay, but we would have to work out every single interaction that occurs through development. And so one of the ways that scientists have tried to get around this, okay, is by using donor organs from other individuals, Okay? So, for example, there was a woman who lost her trachea because she had tuberculosis. Okay? Well, you can't really live without a trachea, but you can put a tube in for a while and try to see what, you know, try to get a trachea meanwhile, right? So, trachea, of course, if you would just transplant a trachea, you would then have immunorejection. Have to be on immunosuppressors for the rest of your life. Okay, I don't know if I mentioned it, but you realize that also in this case, you wouldn't need immunosuppressors. So for neither of these cases. Okay? So in this case, what they did with the trachea is they took a trachea, a donor trachea, and they got rid of all of the cells on the trachea, but left the extracellular matrix proteins. If you remember, Dr. Moshowitz spoke about the fact that cells secrete various extracellular matrix proteins, and they give the form or structure of the trachea. And then they took bone marrow cells, stem cells, from the woman who has lost her trachea, and put them then on this extracellular matrix structure of the trachea. Let them grow, transplanted it back into her, and voila, a new trachea. Now, someone will raise their hand and say, but didn't she have an immune response to the extracellular matrix proteins that were there from on the trachea that was from the previous person? Okay? So what happens is it's a process, but slowly but surely, those extracellular matrix proteins are turned over. And the cells that are there now start to secrete their own. So pretty quickly, the extracellular matrix proteins then belong to the woman that received the trachea. Okay, so this just gives you kind of an idea of where scientists are going with all of this. Another one that you may have heard about in the news is they try to do some of the same things with bladders. Okay, and they've had pretty good success. You know, that they take the shape of the bladder and get rid of the cells and add new cells and do that also. So there's been really some success with those kinds of experiments. Hopefully down the road with these ES cells that we're creating, we'll also be able to figure out ways to actually use this for therapeutic cloning. Okay, so with that, I'd like to finish up what I'm going to talk about stem cells, and I'd like to ask if you have any questions before I go on. Yeah? Okay, so the reason they did this with a nucleus from individual B and an egg from individual A is because they wanted to show that it wasn't that there were certain things here in the egg that were enabling this to that. Let me put it another way: that every protein that Dolly was expressing, right, was actually derived from the DNA from B. Okay, if they had used the same person's egg and nucleus. Okay, they wouldn't have been able to test that it was all the nuclear DNA that was causing Dolly to be who she is, right? It's all the proteins that she expresses. So that by using two different sheep, they were able to show that it's the nuclear DNA that's very important. Is that clearer?
Right. But what's the purpose of the mitochondrial DNA?
So the mitochondrial DNA is very important in respiration. Okay, Dolly actually was a white sheep as opposed to a black sheep. Various physical characteristics that you see, the mitochondria usually do not contribute to. So you could test all of those that you know normally are determined by the nuclear DNA.
So if it comes from one source, it won't have any mitochondrial DNA, or it won't keep different.
You mean here?
Yeah. So.
They do, but from the same index, so right, there would be mitochondria in this cell too. He actually just took cells and grew them, right? Like if he took an egg that got fertilized and grew it. And so they'd have both mitochondrial and nuclear DNA from the same individual.
So it wouldn't be cloned, it would just be grown.
That's right. But he claimed it was cloning. And he claimed that it was somatic nuclear transfer. And with this procedure, you'd have to have a difference in nuclear and mitochondrial DNA, and he didn't. Yeah. What hypothesis?
That DNA is the only responsible for the characteristics of the offspring.
I do. There is the exception that, of course, metabolism can be controlled by the mitochondrial DNA from the egg, but all of those major characteristics that are known to come from the nuclear DNA did, in fact, you know, they did, when they checked it, did, in fact, pan out to be from individual B with the sheep. Yeah.
Had this addition of transcription factors to already differentiated cell make it?
Great question. So scientists are working like crazy trying to figure that out. In some way, it reprograms the DNA, okay? And part of that, if you think about it, is by changing the chromatin, the histone modifications, changing the DNA methylations, okay? Changing, like, X chromosome inactivation. There's all kinds of things that actually usually get reprogrammed in the egg that in some way these master regulatory genes or transcription factors are reprogramming. Is it as efficient as an egg? No. And in fact, we now are using, you know, four factors, which is great that we can get so few. But I'm willing to bet if we want the efficiency to go up, we're going to have to add some more things. Because the egg is an amazing thing. It can reprogram DNA to make us have a life cycle, right? So we don't just progress slowly but surely down that cell differentiation pathway. We can actually go back to the beginning. And so, yes, these four transcription factors at a very low frequency can do what the egg does. But the egg's much better at it. Yeah. So this is a little bit more detail, but they actually looked at various genes that are expressed in embryonic stem cells, took a lot of them, okay, and then tried to eliminate one each time or to eliminate, you know, these ones and what happens, and they saw which ones, if you eliminate them, you don't ever get it. And that's how they figured it out. Okay, and so I'm going to go on. If you have more questions, feel free to ask me or come during office hours. I know that stem cells are a hot issue. What I'd like to spend the rest of the time talking to you about is about self-fate determination, like we spoke about last week. And I picked, you know, you think about it, when I was thinking, oh, what should I pick to talk about? I said, what will the students be interested in? Maybe we'll talk about sex. Good choice. Right. Okay, so I've decided to talk about how we become either male or female, and what do I mean by that, okay? So there's actually four different decisions, right? I've written them up here as the four big decisions, okay? What will your gonad become? What will your ducts, or your tubes that lead the primordial germ cells out of the body, okay, what will they be? Will they be male or female ducts, okay? And our external genitalia, will they be male or female? Okay, and then our fourth decision is what will the primordial germ cells become, sperm or egg? Okay, and in mammals, we know that the very beginning, when we think about it, it's actually determined by the chromosomes we get. So if you're XX, you're female. If you're XY, you're male. But what does that actually mean? What does that actually determine? So it turns out that what if you're XX or XY, what you're actually determining is the sex of the gonad. That is the big decision. And then the sex of the gonad determines all the rest. But the chromosomes determine the sex of the gonad. Will it be a testes or will it be an ovary? And it actually determines the somatic tissues of the gonad. You should know that in all of the animal kingdom, the primordial germ cells do not exist in the gonad to begin with. They are somewhere else. And they migrate in. And they become whatever sex the gonad is. So if the gonad that they migrated into is a testes, they become sperm. And if the gonad they migrated into is an ovary, they become an egg. Okay? So the chromosomes are actually determining the sex of the gonad. So that's two decisions, right? We've decided what the gonad will be. And that's the primary decision, the big one. And then, whatever this sex this is, okay, the PGCs will then become also. So that's decision number two. Then the gonad will then induce the ducts. And these are the tubes that the PGCs use to get out of the body. then also the gonad will determine the genitalia. So this will be decision number 3 and decision number 4. Okay. And now if you turn to 20A, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about what happens in the gonad. So the gonad is derived from mesoderm, and if this is the body, and this would be the cavity of your stomach, this here is called the genital ridge and will become the gonad, right? The testes or the ovary. And realize that this means that the same tissue can become two things, bipotential, right? Normally we talk about the lungs becoming the lungs and the heart becoming the heart. But here the gonad can become either the testes or the ovary. That's kind of special, okay? And you actually have something that can become either at about 6 weeks. And I'll draw that around this time, a little bit after that, the PGCs migrate in. If this individual has XY chromosomes, you will eventually get a testes. And when we start off here at 6 weeks, there are what we call the sex cords here on the outside, okay, where the PGCs have kind of migrated here in between them. And by the time we get here to 8 weeks, those sex cords have moved into this middle and form a shape kind of like spaghetti. And there's lots of spaghettis. Okay, all throughout this gonad, I've only drawn you one, but there's lots of them. Okay? And those spaghettis are the Sertoli cells. Now, in between these, you'll have primordial germ cells. And you'll also have some cells in between that. I'll draw them differently by making them squares. And these are called the Leydig cells. Now please realize that all of this is somatic tissue except for the PGCs, right, which are created by meiosis, or will do meiosis, okay? What we see is we get further differentiation at 16 weeks. Now, I've drawn you this kind of from the side. Now I'm going to take and rotate this 90 degrees, okay? What we see is that, because we have many spaghettis, right, is that you start to get these tubes. I shouldn't say, these spaghettis, okay, that kind of form a network, okay? Once again, remember that the spaghettis are the Sertoli cells, and in between them you'd have PGCs, but also you'd have these Leydig cells. Now, I'll mention to you already that the Leydig cells later are going to secrete testosterone. And I'll also mention to you, and we haven't talked about it yet, but we will get to it, that the Sertoli cells secrete something that we'll abbreviate. It's called anti-Müllerian hormone, AMH. We'll talk about it in a moment. And this is really what happens in the male. Now let's talk about the female. So at this same time period, at 8 weeks, those sex cords that are now in the middle, right? This here, maybe I should label this. This is called the sex cords. Degenerate, and you don't have them anymore. And you get new sex cords out here on the outside. And since these are in the center, and these are on the outside, we call these the medullary sex cords. Whereas these are the cortical sex cords. And these then become what cells that are called the granulosa cells. Very much like over here, the sex cords that is this spaghetti were called the Sertoli cells. And in between there are other somatic cells that are called fecal cells. And of course, the PGCs are interdispersed. And then if I once again rotate this 90 degrees, what we get on the, and they're pretty much on the, really based mostly on the outside, we get these somatic cells around a PGC. Each one encompasses one primordial germ cell. Okay, so on the inside here we have PGCs. And then we have that the granulosa and the fecal cells together form a follicle. Okay, so I've told you what happens, right? Now I'd like to talk to you about the mechanism or the genes or the proteins, the genes that make the proteins that are behind this. Behind these events. So, in the male, so XY, there's a master regulatory gene, okay, which means it's what kind of protein? A transcription factor, right? Called SRY. So it's a master regulatory gene, which okay means it's a transcription factor. And it's also on the Y chromosome. Finally, it is also expressed in Sertoli cells. It turns out there's another transcription factor that is on in the bipotential gonad, so from the beginning, called SF1. If SRY is around, it keeps it on. And the two of these together activate another transcription factor called SOX9. So remember, all three of these are transcription factors. And now they're going to start to activate various signaling molecules. For example, FGF9. Another one is anti-malarian hormone is activated actually by both of these. Together they activate anti-malarian hormone. You remember that I told you back here that the Sertoli cells produce anti-malarian hormone. Okay? In addition, SF1, expressed in the Sertoli cells, activates a signaling cascade that actually affects the Leydig cells. Okay? To start producing the hormones, start producing the enzymes for testosterone. Which then, as a result, make testosterone. Okay. So by having a Y chromosome, SRY is expressed. It keeps on SF1. The two together activate SOX9. And then SOX9 and SF1 together activate all of these various signaling molecules so that in the end, Sertoli cells are expressing AMH, and Leydig cells are expressing testosterone. Okay, so what's happening in the female? So the female is XX. And in this case, once again, WNT4 is on in the bipotential gonad. WNT4, I will tell you, is a paracrine factor. It is on in the bipotential gonad, and so in fact I'll put asterisks next to both of these because they are on from the beginning. And if SRY is around, it inhibits WNT4. So if SRY isn't around, WNT4 stays on, activates the master regulatory gene for ovary called DAX1. I'm going to turn the mic down. DAX1 is the master regulatory gene for ovary, and it is on the X. And it activates a number of genes. I will tell you that its pathway is not as well worked out as is what happens in the male, but I can tell you that there is a transcription activating factor that works with polymerase 2 called 150 that is on, that DAX1 turns on and is important in making sure that the proteins that are transcribed are a specific subset that's important for ovary. And the ovary cannot develop without this transcription activating factor. So it is essential. Okay, so this is what's happening in the gonad. And you can see that it's really affected by whether you're XY or XX. Okay, because SRY is on the Y and DAX1 is on the X. And so we've actually now talked about the primary decision. What I've said is the first decision up there with the gonad. Now, the gonad is going to decide all this other stuff. And so if everything works properly, right, if the gonad is a testes, everything else will be male. And if the gonad is an ovary, everything else will be female. Now, since you will be, even if things don't work out well, you are viable, we've actually been able to look at what happens when things go wrong. And so we actually kind of understand some of this process because of that, okay? So let's see what is that next thing. So first of all, the PGCs then migrate into the gonad and become whatever sex the gonad is, okay? In addition, the gonad is now going to affect ducks. So to describe that to you, I need to now draw a picture of the ducks, and that's also on 20A at the bottom. And if we talk about it week 6, so the same time when I drew the bipotential gonad, now I look to see what's going on with the tubes that will bring the PGCs out of the body. What do we see? So if this is the bipotential gonad, we have two sets of tubes, okay? So this is the gonad, okay? We have two sets of tubes, which means every individual at 6 weeks has four tubes, okay? If things progress properly, you'll end up with two tubes, okay? So this tube here, this inner tube, is called the Wolfian duct. And it develops in males. And this other set of tubes, the outer set, is called the Mullerian. And it forms in females. Now I've told you that the gonads induce this and make this decision as to which tubes will form. So it turns out that the Wolfian, in order to remain, just going to abbreviate it W, requires testosterone. Without testosterone, it degenerates. The Mullerian is inhibited. Maybe I should draw this the other way. So, if testosterone is activating the Wolfian, AMH, or anti-Mullerian, that's what the tube's called, hormone is inhibiting the Mullerian tube. So in the males, we have that the gonad, the Sertoli cells are secreting AMH, getting rid of the Mullerian, and the Leydig cells are secreting testosterone, preserving the Wolfian tube. Now you'll notice that this is very different than what we saw for the gonad. The gonad could become either ovary or testes. Here, each of these tubes can only become one thing. So, what happens, or what does this look like, if we now have testes? Which means that we have both testosterone and AMH. T for testes. What we get is then tubes that hook up with the testes. And just so you get an idea of what I'm talking about, over here we had these spaghettis, okay? They now are going to hook up with the ducts. The ducts will be like right here. They're going to hook up And where they hook up this structure right here is called the epididymis. And then this region, liven things up a little. Okay. This region here is called the vas deferens. And I realize that's not actually on your figure, so feel free to add it. And this is what happens, I didn't put it on here, but this is what happens at 12 weeks. I think that's actually labeled on your handout. It's part of it, right? So it becomes three things. It becomes the epididymis, the vas deferens, and a couple of glands that we won't go into. Okay? You'll see that more in detail when we turn the page over. People couldn't stand it, right? Gotta turn that page over. Okay, great. What happens with the ovary? Okay? So this is the Wolfian. I'll write a W next to it, right? That's the Wolfian tube that gets divided into three parts. The epididymis, which is the connection with the gonad. The vas deferens is this tube going out and a couple of glands. Okay, so now what happens for the you have an ovary? So the Müllerian tube, which is what this is, okay, so this is my Müllerian tube. This is my gonad. I don't want to write in it O because you'll just think it's a nucleus, but these are, maybe I'll write it up here, ovary. All right. So this is, this part of the Müllerian tube is the oviduct. This is the uterus. And this then, well, there's the part here that's thickened, that's the cervix, and then down here the vagina. And you'll notice that this is a little different than what happens in the male, because you have a region of this tube, this Müllerian tube, that is fused to form our uterus. And in fact, different animals fuse it different amounts or different degrees. If you think about it, a mouse's uterus, which is also a mammal, has horns to it and isn't nearly as fused as ours is. And what patterns this and makes the oviduct different than the uterus and different than the vagina is estrogen. So estrogen patterns this. And for a long time, a number of people took a drug, okay, called diethylstilbestrol. I won't even try to write that, but it's abbreviated DES, okay? And this is an estrogen agonist. It does the same thing as estrogen. People took this from about 1940 through 1970, hoping to prevent miscarriage, pregnant women. Okay? And because estrogen patterns this Müllerian tube, okay, first of all, I should say that it didn't actually prevent miscarriages. They thought it would, and it turns out it has no effect on miscarriages, so it's very unfortunate that people took it. But they did take it for about 30 years. And what happens is that with when you take this DES, the amount of estrogen or estrogen-like acting factors increases. And your fusion, because the fusion is inhibited by estrogen, you don't get that your uterus fuses as much as it should. Now, when I say that, it's not the mother that took the pill that's affected because her uterus is already formed. It's the baby in her stomach, if it's a female, that uterus does not form properly. So they have a shortened uterus, and they frequently cannot carry their babies to term. mothers who had boy embryos also had some effects on their genitalia. As you can imagine, having these increased levels of estrogen is not good for them either. Okay? We won't go into the details here, but please realize that that affected also the boys. But for the female embryos, it really affected the fusion, okay, the fusion place of the uterus. In fact, there's a book called My Year of Meats by Ruth Ozaki that talks just about this problem, okay? I'm sorry? Meats. Like meat, like the meat you eat. Frequently people give DES to cattle, or they used to, they don't do it anymore, and the effects of that. Okay. All right. So, this is the duct system and how it develops. Finally, we've gotten to the external genitalia. Now remember, this is also affected by the gonads. And this now is on 20B, for those of you who haven't already flipped the page. So what we see is that the same tissues that form the male external genitalia also form the female external genitalia. And they all start off from the perineum, which is a tissue from going from your belly button to your anus. They all are derived from there. And they all, if you look at it, let's look at the, in the males and in the females. So both of them have the anus derived from the same tissue. The penis is derived from the same tissue as the clitoris plus the labia minor. And in order to kind of explain that to you, I'd like to draw that. So let's see. Okay, so this being the opening for the vagina, and this being the labia minor, and this being the labia major, and this being, so obviously this is female, right? I should mention that. This being the clitoris. Well, you know, be on the safe side. Okay, so what happens here, now I want to explain to you a little something. If you think about it, the urethra in males and females is not really in the same place, right? So in males, it's actually, the urine actually comes out at the end of the penis, right? For females, it's not actually inside the clitoris. So it's different, okay? What's actually going on? So in the females, it's about here, okay? It turns out that in the males, when the shaft elongates, it actually takes this part, which will become the head of the penis or the glans penis, and this fold that is the labia minor and elongates together with it. When it does that, this urethra kind of gets in, so the elongating structure kind of looks like this, and the urethra is sitting here, and slowly but surely it penetrates into the middle so that in the end, the urethra is actually, if we're looking from the, this is a cut section, I know that's painful, but anyways. This would be the urethra here in the middle, whereas here the urethra is outside of the clitoris, and that's because all of these tissues elongated. Okay? Now, we have left then the labia major. And so the labia major in the female closes, okay, and becomes the scrotum, which holds the testes. Now, if you remember, I drew them for you up here. And yes, it's true, when they start off, they're up here. But as a result of testosterone and some other factors, they actually descend into the scrotum. But that isn't true for all animals, okay? So just something to think about. It's amazing when you look at it, the variance that you see between various animals. And I frequently think, and I realize I'm not a man, so you can all make these decisions for yourselves, but that's a little uncomfortable, okay? You know, right? So having the fact that you've got your testes between your legs as opposed to inside and out of the way. So it turns out that there are mammals, right, that actually have their testes inside, right? Why not have them inside if you can choose? So I frequently tell my students in developmental biology that I think males should prefer to be an elephant, okay? Elephants have it good. First of all, they have their testes inside. Perfect. They have a special air conditioning system that cools them off, and they're happy, okay? Obviously, they reproduce well, right? In addition, elephants have a bone in their penis. Humans don't, right? They got to worry about all these hydraulics. Does it work? Doesn't it work? There's none of that, right? Yeah, so that... And the other thing is that elephants have a good, okay, is they actually have a retractile penis. So it's only there, out there, when they need it. So I think that elephants, all of you should rethink, you know, to decide what you want. But I think elephants have it good, as far as the, you know, external genitalia goes. But you can make those decisions on your own. Okay. So I've left out one, I need to mention another thing here. And that is that, what causes these various structures to form? Why is it different in the male than in the female? I've drawn for you here the female, okay? On your handout, you have a reasonable picture of the male. And if you look actually in the middle of the page, you will see that we've actually taken like a cross-section, and you can see the male genitalia. And what they've... And this is at 12 weeks, right? So when things are differentiated into male genitalia and female genitalia, what they see is that... The Wolfian duct requires testosterone, as I've told you. But in order to get a penis and a scrotum, and also a prostate, okay, you need to have another chemical. Okay, it's more potent than testosterone. It's called 5-alpha-dihydrotestosterone. I think it's actually written there on your handout, which we abbreviate as DHT. And so in order for your scrotum to fuse, okay, and I don't know if how many of you noticed or looked or whatever, you'll see there's actually still a line there on your scrotum of where it has actually fused, right? The two sides had to come together, okay? In order for that to happen, and in order for a penis to form, you need to have this more potent form of testosterone called DHT. Okay? And in order to get this, you have to have an enzyme called 5-alpha reductase. And if you don't have that enzyme, DHT isn't created, and you would have a testes... And you would have your internal ducts, but your external genitalia would look female. And this is what happened in Middlesex. Any of you have read or heard about the book Middlesex? This is what happens. This person in Middlesex is missing 5-alpha reductase. As a child, everything externally looks female. When puberty hits, there's more testosterone, and so things start to develop a little, but a penis, elongated penis never really forms, and all the problems that are associated with that. That's what Middlesex is about. Okay? Okay, so another thing about males, which is, I think, a minus, is that for some reason evolution, What does Elaine say in Seinfeld? That she's glad she doesn't have to carry that stuff around? Okay. is that there are, in females, one tube to get babies out, right, or get your germ cells out, and one tube to urinate, okay, two different places. In males, they've combined the two, right? Sperm and urine come out the same tube. And there's actually a prostate, right, which is this prostate gland that needs DHT to form, that sits right there at the union, right, where the tubes or the vas deferens come in towards the, are coming from the testes and meet up with the urine. And then there's the urethra that brings them both out. And you have to be able to switch between the two. Well, prostates are a huge problem for men, okay? Whether it's leakage, whether it's prostate cancer and enlargement. So it turns out that DHT, okay, its function in embryo is to create the penis and the scrotum and the prostate. Later in life, what it does is it makes the prostate grow, which is a huge problem for males, and it causes male pattern baldness. And a lot of the drugs that we give in order to try to reduce male pattern baldness or get rid of it is before you lose your hair. You can't do this after you've already lost it. It's too late. But before you lose your hair, there are two drugs. One's called Proscar and one's called Propecia that both are important in blocking this enzyme. So you won't have DHT. In addition, some men who have problems with enlarged prostate are given these same drugs to decrease the amount of DHT. The problem with this is that it has some effect on virility. So a lot of men don't want to take it unless they have to. Okay? There are ways for the hair that they try to do it more locally, so it'll have a local effect on your head as opposed to your whole body. But this is one of the pluses and minuses of that. So really, in the adult, the effects of DHT are very different than in the embryo, and that's something that, you know, you're going to see again and again. I guess I want to bring that up when we talked about estrogen, right, with the DES, having a different effect when the women took the DES in utero, right? They took the DES. It didn't affect their genitalia. It affected their embryos. Because the embryos at that stage are very sensitive. Their growth of their genitalia are very sensitive to these hormones. Okay? So I'd just like to sum up by going to the bottom of 20B and showing you that there's a very nice summary of all the things we've talked about how sex gets determined. Anything inside the box is something that's happening, okay, in the ovary or in the testes and is determined by the chromosomes. The things that you see outside of the box, right, on the right-hand side, not the stuff at the beginning where it says genital ridge and bipotential gonad, right, but the stuff on the right, all of that, okay, is then caused by the gonads, either through hormones or paracrine factors. Questions about sex determination? Yeah.
Since the male also has an X chromosome, is there something about the whole SRY pathway that inhibits DAX1, or is there some way that that's turned off?
Ah. So,
can you repeat the question?
Sure, I'm sorry. He asked if, because a XY individual will also have an X chromosome, is there something, what happens then to the DAX1 on the other chromosome in that individual? Okay? So it has to do with dosage and that SRY is able to inhibit the... to inhibit what's going on the X chromosome, But it turns out that there's also some other factors that go into this that I haven't actually mentioned, but that's a great question. I mean, there is an issue with the copy and the expression of those factors that makes a big difference, right? So it doesn't inhibit any amounts, but it inhibits when there's a certain amount. Yeah. Yes? Increased amounts of estrogen will inhibit the uterus from fusing. And so it fuses here, right? If you increase the amounts of estrogen, it'll only fuse till here.
So it's just above normal levels of estrogen or estrogen.
Right. It's this increased amounts.
It fuses with the bladder?
No.
The
two Mullerian tubes fuse to each other, right? As opposed to here, where they stay separate, okay? Until they get to the prostate and go towards the bladder, they stay separate. Whereas here, they're together, right? So the vagina, the cervix, and the uterus are all fused together. Yeah?
Is SF1 turned off in females?
Yes, because they don't have SRY activating it, right? So SF1 is on in the bipotential gonad, but goes off if it doesn't get activation from SRY. Excuse me. Yes. Yeah.
You said SRY is sort of the determining factor, and that's also like a question of dosing. If SRY is not there, it doesn't work. Is there enough in the one Y chromosome to just sort of default to the development?
So if you had a Y chromosome, you would have SRF unless you had some funky recombination event. Did I understand your question correctly?
Yeah, so if it was a mutation in the gene for SRY that just didn't work and didn't get produced, is there enough in the X chromosome?
So there is no SRY on the X. There's only on the Y. So you would be female.
Good. So the default would be female. And there's enough of
DAX1 to be female? Yes. Yeah.
Do we know why the body bothers to make both of the tubes and sort of expend that extra energy as opposed to having one thing that can go either way?
So I don't know. It is true, though, and you're pointing this out, that the gonad is bipotential, and the perineum, or this tissues between your belly button and your anus, are bipotential, okay? But those tubes are not. And so, right, you do have degeneration. I would say that, I don't have a good explanation for that, but there are a number of tissues in the body where you get many more cells than you'll use in the end, and those cells that aren't used then end up dying. But you're right, this is kind of special, where you on purpose are going to have one that dies. Okay, so I'm going to stop with questions there, but I wanted to tell you that if you're interested in those topics, or you're interested in the stem cells, because I saw there was lots of questions, feel free to sign up for my class. That'd be great.